on its seriousness had been the number of votes this key liberal proposal had actually received in the caucus. 12. Johnson had received 51. Richard Russell said that the liberals' position reminded him of a bull who had charged a locomotive train. That was the bravest bull I ever saw, but I can't say a lot for his judgment. No majority leader in history had ever accumulated anything remotely comparable to the powers Johnson had accumulated. That was why he was able to run the Senate as no other leader had run it. So long as the Democrats controlled the Senate and the Southern Democrats who controlled the Democratic caucus and the chairmanships of virtually all of the most powerful Senate committees supported him, his power within the institution itself would remain solid. The Senate leadership would still be immensely more powerful than the position he was trading it in for. Should Kennedy win, on the other hand, Johnson's position in relation to the world outside the Senate would be diminished both symbolically — he would no longer be the highest elected Democratic official in the country — and in a very concrete way as well. To the extent that there had been a Democratic legislative agenda during the past 6 years, he had had a major role, perhaps the major role, in setting it. Now that agenda would be set by the White House. Legislation, Democratic legislation, would be sent to the Senate for him to pass. Although Johnson's power emanated from the Senate, he had made the Senate felt across the land, Evans and Novak wrote. For the past half dozen years, he, more than any other single Democrat, spoke for his party. Now, if Kennedy won, that would no longer be the case. And if he proved insufficiently compliant with a Democratic president, that president could always move against him. An antagonistic president of his own party could make life difficult for any majority leader. Other considerations, however, were much more than tactical, because they related not so much to a comparison between the Senate leadership and the vice presidency, but to the great aim of his life, the job he had spent so many years scheming and sacrificing to obtain. His chance to win his party's nomination in 1960 was gone now, and if in the general election Kennedy defeated the Republican nominee and served his full 2 terms, he might not get another chance until 1968. There was, of course, a possibility — Kennedy might lose to the Republican — that he would get another chance at the nomination in 1964, but Kennedy, despite his loss, would be coming into that convention as the party's last standard-bearer, and would be even harder to beat than he had just been. It wasn't much of a possibility. 8 years would probably be how long Lyndon Johnson would have to wait. And in 8 years, Lyndon Johnson would be 60, and that was an age that, throughout his life, had loomed before him with a grim, talismanic significance. All during his boyhood, he had heard relatives repeating a piece of family lore, that all Johnson men had weak hearts and died young. Then, while he was still in college and his father was barely 50 years old, Sam Ely's heart had begun to fail, and he had died in 1937, 12 days after his 60th birthday. 2 years later, one of his father's 2 younger brothers, Lyndon's uncle, had died suddenly of a massive heart attack at the age of 57. The other uncle lived to 71, but after suffering a heart attack in 1946 at the age of 65, and a second in 1947, spent his last years as a near invalid. Lyndon, always conscious of his remarkable physical resemblance to his tall, big-eared, big-nosed father, was convinced — convinced, one of his secretaries says, to the point of obsession — that he had inherited the Johnson legacy. "I'm not going to live to be but 60, he would say. "My daddy died at 60, my uncle." With attempts to argue him out of this belief, he had no patience. Once, when Lady Bird was trying to reassure him that he would not die young, he looked at her scornfully and said flatly, "It's a lead pipe cinch." And then, in 1955, at the age of 46, he had had his own massive heart attack. Now, in 1960, with the nomination lost, he felt he couldn't wait 8 years for another chance to win it. When, following Kennedy's victory on Wednesday night, Reedy and Busby had been called into his suite, they had seen how depressed he was, and Reedy had tried to console him by pointing out that he would have another chance in 8 years. There was a long pause before Lyndon Johnson's reply, and when it came in a very low voice. "Too long," he said. "Too long." In addition, waiting, whether it was for 8 years or only four, might not help, so long as while he waited he continued as Senate leader. As long as he stayed in that job, in fact, waiting might make his chances worse instead of better. If Lyndon Johnson's age was one compelling consideration in his thinking, another was that scent of magnolias. Hard as he had tried, supreme as had been the effort he had made in passing those two civil rights bills to scrub off the Southern taint, it still clung to him, almost as strong as ever. And the reaction to the 1960 bill had shown him how hard it would be to ever scrub it off completely as long as civil rights were an issue. And of course civil rights would always be an issue, the issue. With civil rights militancy mounting by the month, it was clear, as Johnson had often explained to aides and colleagues, that the issue was going to become steadily bigger. Whenever he tried again for the nomination, he would be caught again in the trap in which he had found himself during the last congressional session. The South, the Southern supporters he could not afford to alienate in the Senate, would demand the weakening or death of any civil rights bill, a demand which, if he complied with it, would antagonize the North even more. Scrubbing off the scent was going to be difficult, if not impossible, so long as he remained in the Senate. And, of course, if the scent of magnolias remained, it would taint him not only in the convention, but, should he by some long chance win the nomination, in the country as a whole. Should he win the nomination but not the presidential election which followed, he would be only a footnote in history, just another defeated presidential candidate. He wasn't interested in being a footnote. He was interested in being LBJ. And was it possible for him to win a national presidential election with the scent still on him? Was it possible for any Southerner to win? The last Southerner to be elected to the presidency, Zachary Taylor, had been elected in 1848, more than a century before. Would it be possible for a Southerner to be elected now? A Southern candidate would have the 11 Southern states behind him, of course, but with the states of the Northeast and California and the Republican Midwest so solidly against him, it was difficult to see how. Lyndon Johnson did not see how. "I don't think anybody from the South will be nominated in my lifetime. If so, I don't think he'll be elected," he had said flatly to one journalist. As long as he was Senate leader, held responsible by civil rights militants and segregationist militants, by Northerners and Southerners and by the media for the fate of civil rights in that institution, he would not be able to escape being viewed as a sectional candidate from the wrong section. Lyndon Johnson's path to the presidency, that route he had mapped out for himself so long before, had always been narrow, twisting. He had navigated so many treacherous turns, had come much farther along the path than might have been thought possible, but he could go no farther. That route was closed. But there was another route, and he had reconnoitered it. Sometime early in 1960, he had had his staff look up the answer to a question. How many vice presidents of the United States had succeeded to the presidency? The answer was 10. John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Martin Van Buren, John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Andrew Johnson, Chester A. Arthur, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, and Harry Truman. That route was well traveled. Furthermore, for a Texan who had only one goal, that route had some obvious advantages over the Senate leadership. The vice presidency might be a meaningless position, a joke position, when looked at as it was generally looked at, in terms of itself. When looked at as a means of becoming president, it took on a different aspect. For one thing, a vice president was a national figure. As a leader raised to Senate power by the South, Johnson had little choice but to represent Southern interests, to be a sectional leader. He would continue to be, as he had been, bound to the South, just as a senator from Texas, he was bound to Texas oil interests, which were also unpopular in the rest of the country. To realize his great dream, those Southern and Texas ties needed to be cut. As vice president, those ties would be cut to a considerable extent. He would no longer have to represent Texas. The national administration of which he would be a part represented not a state, but a country. He would no longer have to represent the South. The South would be only one section of the country. His positions on issues could be those of an official representing the whole country. Positions that would help, rather than hurt, in a future bid for the presidency. In addition, a vice president was the logical candidate to succeed the president when his 4 or 8 years in office ended, the natural heir to the presidency. And, of course, a vice president might not have to wait that long. The alternative route had an abbreviated version, and Lyndon Johnson had reconnoitered that, too. He had his staff look up a second figure. How many presidents of the United States had died in office? The answer was 7. Since 33 men had been president, there had been 34 presidencies, but Grover Cleveland had served 2 separate terms. That was 7 out of 33. The chances of a vice president succeeding to the presidency due to a president's death were about 1 out of 5. And when that question was asked about presidents in modern times, the odds against such an occurrence got shorter, better. During the last 100 years before 1960, 5 presidents had died in office. Abraham Lincoln in 1865, James Garfield in 1881, William McKinley in 1901, Warren Harding in 1923, and of course Franklin Roosevelt in 1945. During that time span, in other words, a president had died in office approximately every 20 years. There had been 18 presidents during that time, and 5 out of 18 were odds of less than 1 out of 4. Furthermore, those odds seemed even shorter, much shorter, when compared with the odds of a Senate majority leader, or indeed any senator, being elected president. If John F. Kennedy made it to the White House straight from the Senate, he would be accomplishing something that only a single senator, Harding, had accomplished before him. And the odds were perhaps even more favorable when compared with the chances of Lyndon Johnson, the Southerner, being elected in 1964 or 1968, with the civil rights issue still burning in America. Johnson was to reiterate, even during his retirement, his belief that no Southerner would be elected president in the foreseeable future, as when, in 1969, he told Texas's young Lieutenant Governor Ben Barnes, the state's new rising political star, that the only way for a Texan to reach the presidency was through the vice presidency. He never referred to his analysis of the odds in public, of course, and so far as the author of this book can determine, he never referred to it in private during his vice presidency, except on the evening of its first day, the day on which he was inaugurated. Sitting beside him that evening on a bus carrying high-level guests to the inaugural ball, Claire Booth Luce, the former congresswoman and the wife of Time Incorporated publisher Henry R. Luce, asked him why he had agreed to accept the vice presidential nomination, and he replied, "Claire, I looked it up. 1 out of every 4 presidents has died in office. I'm a gambling man, darling, and this is the only chance I got." But during the period immediately following the convention, he explained his thinking several times. Robert M. Jackson, editor of the Corpus Christi Caller Times and a longtime ally, was to tell his reporter James M. Rowe, not the James H. Rowe Jr. of Washington, that, encountering Johnson at the Corpus Christi airport during this period, he had asked him, "Lyndon, why in the world did you accept the nomination?" And that Johnson had replied, "Well, 6 of them didn't have to get elected." When he was asked the same question by intimates in Texas, the precise figure, as often with Johnson, varied from telling to telling, but the theory remained the same. That because it was so hard for a Texan to be elected president, becoming vice president was a Texan's best chance to reach the Oval Office. "Well," he replied when Joe Kilgore asked the question, "6 of them, vice presidents, didn't have to be elected in order to become president. You know, 7 of them got to be president without ever being elected," he told Ed Clark. And of course, if the odds paid off, it might not require waiting 8 years for them to do so. The possibility that fate might intervene was vivid in the mind of anyone who had been in Washington on April 12, 1945, and especially vivid to members of Sam Rayburn's basement Board of Education in the Capitol, where Harry Truman had often sat having a late afternoon drink, and where he had been having a drink when, that day, the summons had come from the White House that had been Franklin Roosevelt's. Lyndon Johnson hadn't been in that room when the summons came, but he arrived there a few minutes later. He had known Truman for years as a senator, and then Harry had been plucked from the Senate to be vice president. And then, less than 4 months after he had been sworn in, he was president. The possibility had been kept vivid in Washington by what had happened during the presidency of Truman's successor. 3 times in 26 months, Dwight Eisenhower had been hospitalized with serious illnesses. In 1955, a heart attack. In 1956, an attack of ileitis, an abdominal obstruction that required surgery. In 1957, a stroke. And each time, the Capitol seethed with rumors that the president might die, or that he had died, and that Richard Nixon would become president, or particularly in the case of the stroke, that Eisenhower might be disabled and that Nixon would, while remaining vice president, assume presidential duties and powers. If John Adams had once called the vice presidency the most insignificant office, he had also on another occasion made a statement that cast the position in a different light. "I am vice president," Adams had said. "In this I am nothing, but I may be everything." All his life, Lyndon Johnson had aimed for a single goal. The path he had originally chosen, he now realized, might be closed to him by the magnolia taint. But there might be another path. As long as he had felt he had a good chance to win the presidential nomination, as he had felt until the West Virginia primary, this alternative route had remained only a dim possibility, and consideration of it had stayed on a back burner. It was winning that nomination that he was focused on. But West Virginia had wakened him to reality. That primary had been held on May 10th. Thereafter, even while he was continuing to try to obtain the presidential nomination by deadlocking the convention, he was careful not to close the door to that alternative route. While before the primary he had been so definitive about never accepting the vice presidential nomination, angrily dismissing reporters' questions on the subject, when, shortly after West Virginia, the question came up at a press conference, he was suddenly not so definitive. "That's a very iffy question," he said, and then added, "When and if my country wants me to serve her, I will give it every consideration." Private as well as public signals were soon being sent out. Ending a conversation with Ted Sorensen in June, Bobby Baker suddenly said, "Maybe the ticket will turn out to be Kennedy and Johnson." "I think that would be wonderful, but I doubt very much that the second man on that ticket would agree to it," Sorensen said. "Don't be too sure," Bobby Baker said, and walked away. And with men whose voices would carry weight in discussions about the vice presidency, Johnson made very sure indeed that the door was not closed, even if keeping it open required him on one occasion to do what he almost never did, disagree to his face with Sam Rayburn. The disagreement occurred in late June while he and Rayburn were meeting with Governor Lawrence and the powerful Democratic fundraiser and Kennedy supporter, contractor Matt McCloskey. To McCloskey's suggestion that it would make a great team if you would take the second spot, Rayburn exploded, "We didn't come down here to talk about the second spot, we came here to talk about the first spot." But Johnson said, "Now wait a minute, Sam. I don't want these boys to go out of here and not know where I stand. First of all, I am a Democrat, and I am going to do anything my party wants me to do." So firm was that statement that Lawrence would mention it to Kennedy at the convention, saying that because of it, he, Lawrence, guaranteed that Johnson would take the job if it was offered. Reiterating a week before he left for Los Angeles the phrase that had caught his fancy, Johnson responded to a reporter's query about the vice presidency by saying, "Well, that is a very iffy question, and I wouldn't want to have it even thought that I would refuse to serve my country in any capacity, from running the elevator to the top job, if I felt that my services were needed." Even at the press conference at which he at last formally announced his presidential candidacy, he was sending the signal, when a reporter offered him, as the New York Times put it, an opportunity to rule himself out as a possible nominee for vice president, he passed it up, saying, "I've been prepared throughout my adult life to serve my country in any capacity where my country thought my services were essential." These signals were overlooked, largely because before West Virginia, he had been saying for months, often and in seemingly unequivocal terms, that he would never, under any conditions, accept the vice presidency. And because prominent figures in the Kennedy campaign, including the most prominent figure, had been saying for months that Johnson would never be offered the vice presidency. Ken O'Donnell, the campaign's liaison with the country's top union officials, was to write that the labor people had warned me repeatedly that they did not want Johnson on the Kennedy ticket. I had promised them that there was no chance of such a choice. These reassurances had continued right into the convention, when some liberal delegates, wavering up to the last minute between Kennedy and Adlai Stevenson, had said they were leaning to Stevenson because they feared there was a chance, no matter how slim, that Kennedy might select Johnson, O'Donnell gave them the same assurance. And this assurance came right from the top. O'Donnell says that he made his promises with Jack Kennedy's knowledge. O'Donnell had not the slightest reason to doubt that the promise would be honored. During the months prior to the convention, he had flown thousands of miles with Jack Kennedy, he was to recall, and once in a while we'd discuss the vice presidency, and he never mentioned Lyndon Johnson's name. Some black delegates and civil rights leaders had the same concern as the labor people, and to Joseph Rao, Jack Kennedy made the same promise, not through intermediaries, but in person. A month before the convention, when Rao told Kennedy that it was important to him that it not be Johnson, Kennedy replied, "It will not be Johnson." Kennedy promised me it would be, and this is a direct quote, "Humphrey or another Midwestern liberal," Rao says. And in the last days before the balloting, that assurance was repeated to other liberals. The assurances were repeated also by the candidate's brother. Robert Kennedy pledged to a number of those working with him, including Rao, who was trying to deliver the District of Columbia delegation, that Johnson would not be on the ticket, the Washington Post was to report. After Humphrey removed himself from contention by refusing to endorse Kennedy, the candidates most often mentioned for the ticket's vice presidential slot were Stuart Symington, Governor Orville L. Freeman of Minnesota, and Senator Henry M. "Scoop" Jackson of Washington. The one name never mentioned was Lyndon Johnson, Arthur Schlesinger states. Quite the contrary, the Kennedy people told everybody as categorically as possible that he was not in the picture. This was the stance not only in public but behind closed doors. There was never any talk in the office that Mr. Johnson was to be running mate, Evelyn Lincoln was to recount. But now, after Kennedy called, Johnson said to Roe, "Power is where power goes," and Roe knew he was really thinking about it. He had 2 hours before Kennedy came down to his suite at 10 o'clock. 2 hours not to decide what he was going to do, because he knew what he was going to do, but to check to see if there was anything he had overlooked. This was no time for the second string, or for anyone who, like Reedy, was intelligent but sometimes flinched from looking harsh realities in the face. For the realities now were very harsh, the choice very tough. 3 men were called to the Johnson suite. The man who knew where all the bodies were buried, the man who had written the Truman memo, and the man who was the most pragmatic of all his aides, not his confidant, for Lyndon Johnson had no confidant, but the man who would do anything for him, and who was also the only man who was tough enough to handle Bobby Kennedy. And when Bobby Baker, Jim Rowe, and John Connolly had arrived, Johnson told them to lay out the reasons why he should or shouldn't accept the vice presidency, should Kennedy offer it. He told Connolly to start off, but the 3 men found themselves in agreement on all the key points, pro and con. "We were not trying to persuade him of the virtues and glories of the vice presidency," Connolly was to recall. "We were looking at it more from a negative point of view. Where does your risk lie?" And he and Rowe both concluded that, in Connolly's words, "your risk lies in declining to accept it." Johnson had a lot to lose by not accepting, they agreed. If he didn't accept, Kennedy would probably lose the election. "He'll never beat Nixon in Texas unless you're on the ticket," Connolly said. Texas was discussed at considerable length. Without Johnson on the ticket, in fact, Kennedy might not, against Nixon, a conservative and heir to Eisenhower, be able to win back the solid South Eisenhower had broken so decisively. And if Kennedy lost the election, Johnson would be blamed for the loss by Northern liberals who already, in Baker's phrase, "hate your guts." They already felt he was not a fully committed Democrat, Baker said. Johnson's refusal to join the ticket would confirm them in that belief. and, the three men agreed, he would be blamed by Kennedy. It could make Kennedy angry and bitter, Baker recalls saying. Connally recalls telling Johnson that if Kennedy lost, you're going to be blamed, because they'll try to ensure that you'll be blamed, and therefore you'll have a large segment of the party against you. If Johnson ever wanted to try for the nomination again, that would make it even harder than it otherwise would be. And if he didn't accept and Kennedy won, the situation might be even worse. As Baker recalls saying, a strong Democratic president will send his own programs up from the White House, would create a legislative agenda that the majority leader would have no choice but to follow. He would have to carry that program unless he wanted to have an open break with the president, Connally explains. Even if he carried it, moreover, an angry and bitter president could make life difficult for a Senate leader. If he didn't accept and Kennedy won, Lyndon Johnson would still be leader, but the leadership might not be nearly as desirable a job to have. And, Connally recalls, I even expressed the thought that he might not be majority leader. The Kennedys play for keeps. I said, you assume that you're still going to be majority leader, but why do you assume that? The Kennedys play for keeps. Bobby plays for keeps. They might say, we won without him. What the hell do we need him for? We don't need him. I told him, I'd hate to see you try to hold on to it, the leadership, in the face of opposition from the president. By accepting, they felt, Johnson ran far less risk. In fact, Baker said, I don't think you have a thing in the world to lose by running with Kennedy. Connally told Johnson that the arguments on that side, that Johnson had no choice but to accept, were overwhelming. For one thing, Kennedy might lose. There were few downsides to that. Suppose you take it and he's defeated. You'll still be senator, and you'll still be majority leader. If Kennedy lost, you can't really be hurt. And what if he took it and Kennedy won? There were definitely downsides to that, as Connally pointed out. You're totally at his command. You almost can't leave town without his permission. You're going to have to listen more than you've ever done. But, the three advisers said, there might be upsides, too, even if these could only be touched upon delicately, in oblique phrases. One had to do with Sam Rayburn. Even if Kennedy won and Johnson was only his vice president, you'll still have the speaker, is how Connally remembers putting it. He meant that as long as Johnson had Rayburn on his side, he would have power behind him. No one thought he could be forced out as speaker, or that the president could do much trying to go around him in the House, he would remember years later. As long as a vice president had Sam Rayburn behind him, the vice president couldn't be ignored. Connally, tough though he was careful to look around before he said even, you'll still have the speaker, to make sure that the speaker hadn't somehow entered the room. We didn't want to make that argument when the speaker was there because we would be presuming, he explains. And then there was another possible upside, one that was in the minds of all three advisers, even though, pragmatic and tough though they were, they mentioned it only in another oblique phrase, in part because perhaps they were not able to think about it other than obliquely. For thinking about another man's mortality often leads to thoughts of one's own mortality, and these are thoughts difficult to confront directly. The phrase was, a heartbeat away. I felt, you're a heartbeat away from the presidency, John Connally says. Asked if he had actually used even that direct a phrase during the conference that morning, he says he can't remember. But Bobby Baker, brasher and younger, says that he used it. He recalls reminding Mr. Leader that as vice president he would be one heartbeat away from the presidency. Rowe couldn't bring himself to say those words. He stayed mostly silent during the conference, and after Johnson had dismissed them, saying Kennedy would be arriving in a few minutes, and Rowe had returned it to his own room, he telephoned to Johnson and said only, on balance, I would take it. I want to see you president one day. Asked by the author almost a quarter of a century later for his reasons, he listed many in his careful, lawyerly manner. Then there was a pause, quite a long one. And that one heartbeat, Jim Rowe said. During the conference with the three men, Johnson was quiet, sober, reflective, obviously analyzing all of it, Connally was to recall. He didn't say much, but what he did say gave them a clue as to what his thinking was. Near the end of the discussion, after he had been, in Baker's word, passive for a long time, he said, perhaps thinking of the intense dislike of many Texans for the Kennedys, "Well, I'll probably have some trouble with my Texas friends if I decide to run." And when Connally had finished his argument that Johnson had no choice but to accept the vice presidency, Johnson said quietly, "Well, I don't disagree with that." And during the conference, there was a call from Texas Congressman Homer Thornberry, who was phoning to offer condolences for losing the presidential nomination. When Johnson told him there might be a vice presidential offer, and Thornberry blurted out, "Oh, you can't do that," Johnson said, "Well, here's my problem," and listed all the reasons why he had no choice but to accept. Listed them so persuasively that Thornberry changed his thinking, and a few minutes later telephoned back to tell him, "I was wrong," that if the nomination was offered, he should accept. Lyndon Johnson wasn't merely thinking about it. He wanted it. One great obstacle stood in his way. John Nance Garner had been Sam Rayburn's friend, his mentor in many ways, and Rayburn had seen what happened after Cactus Jack, a mighty figure on Capitol Hill with the power he wielded as Speaker of the House spilling over to the other side of the Capitol. No man was more influential in the Senate than Garner, one observer noted. Accepted the vice presidential nomination from Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. Had seen how the president increasingly ignored his advice to end what that Texas conservative came to call, privately at first but only at first, this New Deal spending orgy. Garner came to regard Roosevelt as a power-hungry dictator. Roosevelt saw him as an ignorant reactionary, and after Garner split with him for good over Roosevelt's attempt to pack the Supreme Court, it was he whom the Senate chose to deliver the news, "Captain, you are beat," to the president. Garner's expectations of succeeding the president were over, as was his career. When Roosevelt sought a third term, he enlisted in a Stop Roosevelt movement, and on Roosevelt's third inaugural day in 1941, Garner was back in the little Texas town of Uvalde, where he was to live out the rest of a long life as a pecan farmer. "I saw Jack Garner agree to run twice with Roosevelt and go back to Texas a bitter man for life," Rayburn told a friend. Loving Lyndon Johnson as the son he never had, Mr. Sam was firmly opposed to him even considering the vice presidential nomination. The night before he left for Los Angeles, the speaker told his friends, Gene and Ann Worley, "The first thing I'm going to do when I get off that airplane tomorrow is to announce to the world that Lyndon Johnson ain't interested in second spot on a ticket with Kennedy." And after Wyoming's votes had ended Lyndon's dream and Rayburn had cried, he had squared his shoulders and sat up, and then had picked up the telephone in the Texas delegations section and called Johnson, because, as one observer put it, he had had a premonition. "They are going to try to get you to go on the ticket," he said. "You mustn't do it. It would be a terrible thing to do. Turn it down." Power is where power goes. Whatever the equation of power that Lyndon Johnson was using as the basis for his calculations, Sam Rayburn was a major factor in it. Lyndon Johnson couldn't defy him. Whether he wanted the vice presidential nomination or not, he couldn't take it if Rayburn didn't want him to. So after his conference with Connally, Roe, and Baker had ended, he telephoned Earl Clements, with whom Rayburn was comfortable, and asked him to come to the suite. And when he arrived, told him about the vice presidential offer he expected, told him in such a way that, Clements was to say, it was obvious he wants it. And when Clements advised him to accept, Johnson said, "Then I wish you'd go down and convince Rayburn. He's right down the hall." The drama that was to consume the rest of the day, Thursday, July 14, 1960, would play out on two sets in Los Angeles's Biltmore Hotel. One was on the hotel's ninth floor. It consisted of a large three-room suite in one corner of the floor, together with a series of individual standard hotel bedrooms that stretched along a rather dimly lit corridor. All the interconnecting doors had been unlocked so that the suite and bedrooms comprised a single unit. During the hectic days earlier that week, this Kennedy suite had become known by the number on the door of the big corner suite, 9333. The candidate himself slept every night in a hideaway apartment his father had rented for him. But during the day, 9333 was his headquarters. The other set, two floors below and in the corresponding corner and corridor, also with a large suite and adjoining bedrooms stretching down the corridor, was 7333, the Johnson suite. Johnson and Lady Bird slept there during the convention, as did their daughters. John Connolly was in the first of the bedrooms, 7331, Walter Jenkins in 7330, and the rest of the staff had bedrooms farther down the hall. Separating the two sets was the eighth floor, on which Robert Kennedy had a suite, 8315. Governor Lawrence had the big suite on the 10th floor, Stuart Symington on the 6th. Rayburn's suite was on the 7th floor with Johnson's, but at the opposite end of the corridor. The elevator in this section of the hotel was located near the far end of the line of bedrooms at the end of the corridor furthest from the corner suite. That morning, what one reporter referred to as the pushy, sweaty mass of the press, newspaper and magazine reporters and photographers, television cameras, cameramen and correspondents, were clustered around the elevator's doors. Kennedy had arrived at his suite very early, before any reporters had arrived, and it was assumed he was still at his apartment and would come up in the elevator, and might emerge and provide them with a clue as to the identity of the vice presidential nominee. There was another connection between the two sets, however. A back staircase, almost directly across from the 9333 door in the floor's corner, not a narrow back stairway but a broad one, with a broad open landing on each floor, as dimly lit as the corridors. If someone stepped out of the 9333 door of the Kennedy suite and walked almost straight across the hall and down the stairs, he had a good chance of avoiding the press. And that was what Jack Kennedy did, successfully, at about 10:15 that morning. Descending down the two flights of stairs, he knocked on the door of 7333. Johnson opened it. The corridor outside was empty. Reporters and photographers had been stationed outside the rooms of the men considered likely vice presidential nominees, but Johnson was not one of them. Johnson led Kennedy into the living room, and they sat down on a couch, each at an end, half-turned to face each other. Two very tough, very smart men. Someone closed the door to the living room. Johnson congratulated Kennedy on winning the nomination, and then the talk turned to Kennedy's running mate. When Kennedy asked Johnson, as Kennedy was to recall it, if he were available for the vice presidency, Johnson told me that he was. He then suggested that I discuss the matter with various party leaders. Johnson's recollection of his response was that he would consider the offer, but that before he could give an answer, there are a couple of problems that have got to be worked out. The main one was that he couldn't even think of taking the job unless Sam Rayburn agreed, and that Rayburn was dead set against it. You'll have to get him to withdraw his objection. Also, he said, a lot of your own people are going to be madder than hell. You'll have to straighten them out. Kennedy said he had already checked with some of the northern bosses, Lawrence and DeSapio were mentioned, and that they approved. Johnson said Kennedy should talk to labor and liberal leaders, people like Walter Reuther and Soapy Williams. He said Kennedy had said he would do that, and then had turned to the Rayburn situation. He asked Johnson, as Johnson was to recall, if Rayburn had anything against him personally, and whether Johnson would mind if he himself, Kennedy, tried to persuade the speaker to change his mind. Johnson said he wouldn't. Kennedy said he would call back in a couple of hours and left, with quick nods and a smile, to Connolly and Baker and Walter Jenkins, who had come into the suite. Whatever had been said between Kennedy and Johnson, it had been said in terms vague enough so that their purport could be denied. The talk had taken about half an hour. And by the time Kennedy left, there was a reporter, Marvin Miles of the Los Angeles Times, outside the door. We talked mostly about what happened last night, Kennedy told him. When Miles asked him if the vice presidency had been discussed, Kennedy said, nothing specific, before heading back up the two flights of stairs to his suite. And Johnson was similarly noncommittal. Whatever had been said, however, it was said clearly enough so that both men understood it the same way. Calling Baker, Connolly, and Jenkins into the living room, he couldn't locate Roe. Johnson told them, you were right. He offered me the vice presidency. He said he had declined, but Kennedy had insisted, Jenkins recalls. Walking back up the stairs to his suite on the 9th floor, Kennedy was joined a few minutes later by a group of Northern bosses and informed them, as Ken O'Donnell was to put it, that he had just talked to Lyndon, who wanted a little time to think it over, but it looked as though Johnson would take it. As word of Kennedy's visit spread, emotions boiled over among Johnson's supporters who hated the Kennedys. Oklahoma's burly Senator Robert Kerr came barreling into the Johnson suite, livid with rage, shouting at Johnson, Lady Bird, and Baker, "Get me my 38. I'm going to kill every damn one of you. I can't believe that my three best friends would betray me." Johnson motioned Baker to take Kerr into the bathroom and calm him down, but as soon as the bathroom door closed behind them, Kerr slapped Baker across the face so hard that it sounded like a dynamite cap exploding in my head. I literally saw stars. My ears rang. "Bobby, you betrayed me! You betrayed me!" Baker explained the reasoning. Even if Kennedy Johnson loses, LBJ gets better known nationally. If he's elected vice president, he'll be an excellent conduit between the White House and the Hill. And Kerr calmed down, apologized to Baker, and leaving the bathroom, hugged the Johnsons. Emotions were boiling over upstairs, too. Bobby Kennedy was later to state that his brother's offer to Lyndon Johnson had been strictly pro forma, a courtesy to a powerful member of the party, and that he had neither expected him to accept the offer nor wanted him to. The idea that he'd go down to offer him the nomination in hopes that he'd take the nomination is not true. He never dreamt that there was a chance in the world that he would accept it. Bobby said that when Jack returned from Johnson's suite, he said, "You just won't believe it." I said, "What?" And he said, "He wants it." And I said, "Oh, my God." He said, "Now what do we do?" And Bobby said, "The only reaction that the president, Jack Kennedy, had after talking to Lyndon Johnson was just surprise and then concern that he would take it. He never dreamt, he never considered that he would take it. After that, there was a good deal of time spent in trying to get him off the ticket." Bobby's statement is buttressed by a remark that Jack Kennedy made a few days later to a friend, the syndicated columnist Charles Bartlett, a statement made off the record and not put in print by Bartlett until 1964. According to Bartlett, Kennedy told him that his offer to Johnson had been merely a gesture, and not much of a gesture, hardly an offer at all. "I just held it out like this," he said, holding his hand 2 or 3 inches from his pocket, "and he grabbed at it." The Kennedys, Bartlett wrote, were shocked when Johnson seized the offer and held fast to it. Those accounts are given weight by many historians because of Robert Kennedy's repeated and emphatic reiterations of them, and because of the acceptance of those reiterations as accurate, and the restatement of them in books and articles by Arthur Schlesinger, whose writings on John and Robert Kennedy have for decades set the template for the image of the two brothers in history. In 1984, Schlesinger would still be writing, "As Robert Kennedy's oral history makes clear, the offer of the vice presidential nomination was pro forma. The Kennedys never dreamed Johnson would accept." Those accounts are not, however, supported by a number of actions that John F. Kennedy actually took that day. The first had occurred before his visit to Johnson's suite. It occurred first thing that morning at about 6:30 a.m., telephoning Bobby in Suite 8315, he asked him to find out the number of electoral votes that could be won in the November election in the northern industrial states plus Texas. A few minutes later, Ken O'Donnell and Kennedy Press Secretary Pierre Salinger were summoned to 8315. Bobby was in the bathtub but called out to them through the door, "How many electoral votes are we going to get if we capture the East, Northeast, and the Solid South?" The Solid South, Salinger realized, included Texas. "Are you talking about nominating Lyndon Johnson?" Salinger asked in astonishment. "You're not going to do that." "Yes, we are," Bobby Kennedy said. Jack would be going down to Lyndon's suite at 10 o'clock to make the offer. "Thereupon," Salinger says, "there ensued a violent argument between Kenny and I and Bobby." Bobby's response was to point out that Johnson had great strength in the South. The second action that Jack Kennedy took occurred after his trip down to Johnson on the 7th floor, immediately upon his return to his own ninth-floor suite. Before going down to see Johnson, Kennedy had telephoned Governor Lawrence, his quarters were on the 10th floor, to remind him of his guarantee that if the vice presidential nomination was offered to Johnson, he would accept it. And Lawrence, anxious to have Johnson on the ticket because he felt Southern electoral votes were necessary for victory, had not only come down the flight of back stairs to reaffirm his guarantee in person, but had also brought the witness to Johnson's words, Matt McCloskey, with him. Kennedy had taken them into 9333's bathroom for privacy, and then had said, as McCloskey recalls it, "I don't want to go down and ask that guy if he won't accept the offer. Are you sure now?" Lawrence and McCloskey had reassured him, had in fact, in McCloskey's words, authorized him to say to Johnson that the two of us had assured him that this was what Johnson had said. Now, having met with Johnson, Kennedy returned to 9333 moments before Lawrence and McCloskey came back in, to be followed shortly by Governors DeSalle and Ribicoff and Mayors Daley and Wagner, along with Connecticut's Bailey and Tammany's DeSapio and Chicago's Jake Arvey. The old pros from the North, as one reporter put it. When Jack told the group that it looked as though Johnson would take it, Lawrence, with a happy grin on his weathered old Irish face, reached out and grasped Kennedy's hand in congratulations, to be met with a matching smile from the young candidate. Suddenly, in O'Donnell's words, all of them, all the Northern bosses who could count, and who had not previously been able to count enough electoral votes for Kennedy to win, all of them milling around Jack Kennedy were congratulating him for offering the vice presidency to Johnson. Lawrence was telling him that Johnson has the strength where you need it most. "I could have belted him, Lawrence," O'Donnell was to recall. He had become very emotional. When Bobby had shouted out the news from his bathtub, "I was so furious I could hardly talk. I thought of the promises we had made to the labor leaders and the civil rights groups, the assurances we had given that Johnson would not be on the ticket. I felt that we had been double-crossed." Telling Bobby, "Now Nixon can say Kennedy is just another phony politician who will do anything to get elected," he had demanded a chance to talk to Jack Kennedy himself, and Bobby had brought him upstairs so that he could do so. Seeing the expression on O'Donnell's face, Jack took him into the bathroom and closed the door behind them, and attempts to maintain that Kennedy's offer was pro forma, that he really didn't want Johnson, have to take into account O'Donnell's story of what happened when O'Donnell began to argue against the choice of Johnson. "Wait a minute," Kennedy said. "I've offered it to him, but he hasn't accepted it yet, and maybe he won't." "But," Kennedy said, "if he does accept it, let's get one thing clear." He then pulled out all the arguments that might work with O'Donnell's labor and liberal clientele, none of the arguments terribly convincing. One was, "I won't be able to live with Lyndon Johnson as the leader. Did it occur to you that if Lyndon becomes vice president, I'll have Mike Mansfield as the leader, somebody I can trust and depend on?" Another, that the offer had been made to keep Johnson and Rayburn friendly so that liberal labor legislation could be passed in the upcoming rump session of Congress. "Lyndon Johnson we don't worry about, but Sam Rayburn is a tough cookie and well-liked and respected." One other argument would be, in retrospect, terribly poignant. It didn't matter who was vice president, Jack Kennedy said. "I'm 43 years old and I'm the healthiest candidate for president in the United States. You've traveled with me enough to know that I'm not going to die in office, so the vice presidency doesn't mean anything." But whether O'Donnell's clients were persuaded by those arguments or not, Jack Kennedy said, and whether O'Donnell himself was persuaded by them or not, that was the way it was going to be. "You get your tail over and get your labor friends," he said. "You get them and tell them this is the way it has got to be." He wanted no backtalk, O'Donnell recalls. Kennedy said Johnson had surprised him by being receptive, but the important thing was to get him on the ticket. He said getting Johnson on the ticket was worth it, and I was to go to my clientele and make them see it. There followed summonses to the top Kennedy staff people, such as Lawrence F. O'Brien, his national campaign director, to come to the ninth floor. And when they arrived, they learned that, as O'Brien puts it, Jack Kennedy had made a decision that he'd like to have Lyndon Johnson as his running mate. For a moment, O'Brien recalls, I was stunned. It was out of the blue. He had never, he said, given any serious thought to the possibility that Kennedy would offer, or that Johnson would accept, the vice presidential nomination. If I ever really gave more than a fleeting thought to Lyndon Johnson, it would be, he's the majority leader. He isn't going to sacrifice what he has to be on this ticket. But the moment he began to give it serious thought, O'Brien, a keen political strategist, and one who knew the importance of counting, understood Jack Kennedy's logic. The night before, and for so many months before that, ever since 1958, in fact, the Kennedy camp had been counting convention delegate votes, the votes necessary to win the nomination. As soon as the nomination was won, Kennedy had begun counting the Electoral College votes necessary to win the real prize, the presidency. And even a quick preliminary look at those votes showed that without Texas's 24 votes, and at least a few of the other Southern votes in his column, Jack Kennedy stood almost no chance at all of defeating Richard Nixon or any other Republican candidate. Extended analysis was not required, O'Brien was to explain. Jack Kennedy hadn't needed input from others. He had selected Lyndon Johnson because he was perhaps the first to focus on, are you going to be a footnote in history as a nominee for the presidency, or are you indeed going to achieve election? The presence of Lyndon Johnson on the ticket was the single best way, by far, of assuring that the name Kennedy would not appear in history books only in small type at the bottom of a page. With him, Johnson, you had the South and the Southwest. It was a stroke of genius. And O'Brien understood also from Jack Kennedy's mouth that the decision was firm. His trip to Kennedy's suite was just an unbelievable experience, O'Brien recalls. When I got the call that morning, he had felt that obviously the subject was going to be, now let's go over the list of possible vice presidential candidates and let's get a consensus. But there would be no list. It would be Lyndon Johnson. Orders were given on the assumption that Johnson would accept. People fanned out, and there were tasks to do. You had to decide who was going to place him in nomination, who was going to second the nomination. The offer, O'Brien was to say, had been couched in terms of a feeler, because if Kennedy had made a formal offer, and it was turned down, that could be adverse to his campaign. But the offer had been understood. Did Kennedy come back from that meeting with the notion that Johnson would accept it? O'Brien was asked. That he would be thinking about it, O'Brien replied. In contrast to Bobby Kennedy's account that Jack's offer had been pro forma, that he had not wanted Johnson to accept and had hoped he wouldn't, and that Jack Kennedy had vacillated for some hours over whether or not to withdraw the offer, O'Brien says the opposite was true. Asked whether the offer was intended as one that Johnson would decline, O'Brien replied, oh, no. On the contrary, he said the Ninth Floor was worried because we were not at all sure that he would accept. The word would come back, well, no, he's not going to take it, and then, well, he'll think about it some more. This sort of thing just went on and on. But through it all, O'Brien says, one thing did not change, Jack Kennedy's decision. Jack Kennedy had made up his mind this was absolutely the right thing to do, and there were no alternatives. And perhaps most definitively, the story that Kennedy's offer to Johnson was only pro forma, and that Kennedy had not wanted it to be accepted, is made less credible by what Kennedy did that morning to solve the problem of Sam Rayburn. Johnson had said he couldn't even think of accepting the offer unless Rayburn agreed. So Kennedy went down the back stairs again, this time to Rayburn's suite, to try to persuade him to agree. Johnson himself had begun the persuasion process even before Kennedy came down and made the offer, sending emissaries to soften Mr. Sam's opposition. Not just Clements, but Homer Thornberry and Wright Patman. Sam was in the bathroom in his shorts and he was shaving, Patman was to recall. He was blistering mad about Lyndon's even considering the vice presidency. As soon as Kennedy left him, Johnson sent another emissary, Tommy Corcoran, and asked Clements to go back again. Corcoran knew how important his mission was. Johnson was going to do whatever Mr. Rayburn told him to do, he was to say. But neither he nor Clements had any luck with the speaker. Rayburn was adamant about it, Clements was to confess. I wouldn't say I made any headway with him. As Corcoran was walking away from Rayburn's suite, however, He encountered in the corridor a member of Rayburn's House team, Majority Whip Hale Boggs of Louisiana, the state which had voted for Eisenhower in 1956. Boggs told Corcoran that Johnson's presence on the ticket would guarantee that Louisiana wouldn't vote Republican again. Corcoran had him go in and tell that to Rayburn. And Boggs pulled out another argument, one that evidently had some impact on the speaker. Rayburn's distrust of Richard Nixon was legendary in Washington. Boggs told him that without Johnson and the South in the Democratic column, Nixon would win the presidency. "I knew that this was the one thing he didn't want to happen," Boggs was to recall. And Johnson himself telephoned Rayburn. "Mr. Sam reiterated strongly that he felt it would be a mistake for me to take it," he was to recount. The speaker added to his other objections, among them, "He said I could do a better job for the Democratic Party and the country as majority leader," one that was very personal and poignant, coming from a childless man who, for years, had been able to work closely every day with a young man who said he looked on him as a father. "He said he would not be happy without me on the Hill." Johnson emphasized how much the nomination meant to him, however, and when he asked Rayburn to hear Kennedy out if he telephoned, Rayburn said he would. "I think Jack will be calling you soon," Johnson said. "John, I've got to think a little bit," Rayburn said to his aide, John Holton, and Holton gave him the key to his room, and 20-30 minutes later, Rayburn emerged and told Holton that if Kennedy met certain conditions, he would advise Johnson to accept. And when Kennedy did call and came down to see Mr. Rayburn, Rayburn gave his conditions, and Kennedy agreed to them. Within a few weeks, the interview transcript is dated summer 1960, Rayburn gave another assistant, D.B. Hardiman, his account of what had happened when Jack Kennedy came down to see him. "I told him, 'I'm dead set against this, but I've thought it over, and I'm going to tell you several things. If you tell me that you have to have Lyndon on the ticket in order to win the election, and if you tell me that you'll go before the world and tell the world that Lyndon is your choice, and that you insist on his being the nominee, and if you'll make every possible use of him in the National Security Council and every other way to keep him busy and keep him happy, then the objections that I have had I'm willing to withdraw.' Kennedy said to me, 'I tell you all those things.'" Kennedy walked out of Rayburn's suite. "He was positively exuberant," says Boggs, who saw him emerge. Returning to his suite upstairs, he told O'Brien and other aides to set the wheels in motion for Johnson's nomination. O'Brien, for example, was to inform the campaign's various state coordinators that Kennedy had decided on Johnson. If these were the actions of a man who had made a pro forma offer and was hoping it would not be accepted, they were strange ones. Rather, they were the actions of a man who very much wanted Lyndon Johnson on the ticket, and who was determined, despite opposition, to persuade him to accept his offer. When Kennedy left his suite, Sam Rayburn walked, briskly, according to a Dallas Morning News reporter who saw him, down the hall to Johnson's suite. Taking Johnson and Connolly into a bedroom, he had Connolly run through all the reasons why he felt Johnson had no choice but to accept the nomination. When Connolly finished, the great bald head nodded. "I don't like it," he said to Lyndon Johnson, "but I don't think you do have any choice." Jokingly, Johnson said Rayburn had evidently changed his mind since the previous night. "I am a wiser man than I was last night," Rayburn said. The three men assumed Connolly was to say that everything had been settled. And then, Connolly was to say, Bobby Kennedy showed up and said he wanted to see Mr. Johnson. And from that moment, and for approximately the next 3 hours, nothing was settled. And during those hours, what had previously remained, despite all the tension within the boundaries of normal political behavior, was transformed with the admixture of personal hatred into confusion and chaos, a chaos whose aftermath would, during the next 8 years, affect profoundly the shape of American politics, and to a lesser but still surprisingly significant degree, the shape of American history. No two people of the many who were involved can agree on anything that happened during those hours. Each account, and some are quite detailed and convincing, contains statements that are impossible to reconcile with, or that directly contradict, statements in other accounts, which are also quite detailed and convincing. To try to reconcile the recollections of those hours is to be reminded again and again of what Theodore White wrote, after trying to reconcile them. It is a trap of history to believe that eyewitnesses remember accurately what they have lived through. Chronologies of that afternoon's events were later compiled by more than one of the participants, but no two chronologies are the same. There is no agreement, to take just a single example, about the number of meetings that Robert Kennedy held with Johnson, Rayburn, and Connolly, either with one of them alone or with various combinations of the three Texans. Arthur Schlesinger says there were two, Connolly says there were three. In fact, there were probably four. All that is certain is that for 3 hours, Robert Kennedy ran up and down those back stairs. There is no agreement on the number of telephone conversations Jack Kennedy held with Johnson and his allies. Philip Graham, who was in Johnson's suite during part of the 3 hours and later wrote a memorandum trying to recount what had occurred during that time, says there were four such conversations. Rowe says there were three. In the various versions of the afternoon's activities, two meetings, or three, are conflated into one, or what happened in one meeting is divided as if it occurred in two or three. The only summary statement about the meetings that can be made without dispute is that each of them was a drama in itself, a vivid, tension-fraught drama of powerful men in confrontation. In what may have been the first of them, it occurred at about 1:30, the one at which, unexpectedly, Bobby Kennedy showed up and said he wanted to see Mr. Johnson. Bobby did not, in fact, see Mr. Johnson. "I don't want to see him," Johnson said. Lady Bird said she didn't think Lyndon should see him, so John Connolly says, "Rayburn and I saw him." Rayburn and Connolly were waiting, in Graham's phrase, for the obvious, the formal offer of the vice presidential nomination. They were expecting Bobby to formalize the offer his brother had made to Johnson that morning by inviting him, in so many words, to be on the ticket. But the obvious was not what they got. The young man sitting before them in the suite's living room was upset, his hair all hanging down in his face, in Rayburn's description. "He told me that there'd be a fight over Lyndon." In Connolly's recollection, Bobby said, "We've got to persuade Lyndon not to take this vice presidential thing. I don't know why my brother made the offer, but it's a terrible mistake. There's a revolt brewing on the floor. Labor is off the reservation. The liberals are in revolt. You've just got to persuade him not to accept this." And he asked if Johnson would, instead, accept the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee. Rayburn refused that invitation with a single word, "Shit," and went into a bedroom where Johnson, Lady Bird, and Graham were sitting on the twin beds to tell Johnson that perhaps he should talk to Bobby in person. Lady Bird intervened, apologizing by saying she had never yet argued with Mr. Sam, but repeating that she felt LBJ should not see Bobby. Agreeing with her, Graham told Johnson that his position should be that "you don't want it, you won't negotiate for it, you'll only take it if Jack drafts you, and you won't discuss it with anyone else." "All of us were pacing around the bedroom, in and out of the bathroom," Graham says, and finally, in that sudden way decisions leap out of a melee, it was decided. Rayburn would return to the living room and tell Bobby that Johnson would indeed accept the nomination, but only if Kennedy drafted him. By which, it soon turned out, Johnson meant merely that Kennedy would have to publicly make him a formal offer. And I, Graham, was to go phone Jack and tell him Johnson's position directly. Rayburn went back and delivered that message to Bobby, whose response, according to Rayburn, was, "Then it's got to be Lyndon. I'm going up to tell Jack." Racing out of the room, suddenly the door burst open and Bob Kennedy ran out and up the steps two at a time, the Dallas Morning News reported. Brushing past reporters, Bobby shouted, "I can't say anything now." This was the formal offer, or as formal an offer as Bobby was ever going to make, and one not made directly to Johnson. Meanwhile, Graham, pulling Rowe along as witness, went into a vacant bedroom down the hall to telephone Jack Kennedy and tell him Johnson's position. Jack's response did little to immediately firm up the situation. He said something to the general effect that he was in a general mess because some liberals were against LBJ, Graham was to recall. He said he was in a meeting with others right then and that people were urging that no one had anything against Symington. He then asked me to call back for a decision in 3 minutes. When Graham did call back, not in 3 minutes, but in about 10, he and Rowe both agreed that 3 minutes in these circumstances meant 10 minutes. The confusion vanished as far as Jack Kennedy was concerned. Jack was utterly calm, Graham says. It's all set, he said. Tell Lyndon I want him and we'll have Governor Lawrence nominate him, etc. The confusion was not ended in Lyndon Johnson's suite, however, for Bobby Kennedy was to return there several times. On what appears to have been the second of his trips, apparently made while Jack was in the meeting with the liberals upstairs, Bobby was, for a moment, alone with John Connolly in the living room, but only for a moment. Connolly may have been tough enough to handle Bobby Kennedy, but Connolly knew someone who was tougher, and he knew he needed that man now. Going out into the corridor, he started looking for Sam Rayburn. Encountering Horace Busby, he shouted, "Come with me," grabbed his arm, and dragged him back to the suite. "Bobby Kennedy's in there," he said. "You go in there and make sure he doesn't leave until the speaker gets here." Busby went in, and there was Bobby Kennedy pacing furiously, just furiously, you know, just almost at a trot. The glare he gave Busby was the glare he had given Busby before, in the Senate cafeteria, 7 years before, when Lyndon Johnson had come over to the table at which Bobby was sitting with Joe McCarthy. "It was the same expression that I told you about," Busby told the author. It had nothing to do with him personally, he knew. "It was just that I was a Johnson man." It had lost none of its ability to intimidate the timid little speechwriter, and anyway, he was no Rayburn or Connolly, and he knew it. "So I came back out. There wasn't a point in me saying anything to him, I could tell. And I came back out into the anteroom, the suite's vestibule, and told John, who was on the phone, I said, 'I'll try to tackle him from out here, but I'm not staying in there with him.' And at this moment the speaker arrived. You know, the speaker was a short fellow and bald-headed, completely bald, and he looked at me and he said, 'Where is the little son of a bitch?' And I said, 'He's in there.' And he said, 'What the goddamn hell is he trying to do now?' The short, bald-headed man opened the door and went in to see Bobby Kennedy. He wasn't in there long, and then the door burst open, Bobby sprinted past us out in the hall, disappeared. Rayburn came out right behind him. Connolly was standing in the vestibule, and Walter Jenkins had come in, and everyone asked Sam Rayburn what had happened inside. And none of them would ever forget Sam Rayburn in that moment. He was old, and he was blind, and, as would soon become apparent, he was very, very ill. But as he told them what had happened, he didn't seem old or blind or ill. He said that Bobby Kennedy had told him that liberal and labor leaders were going to stage a floor fight against Johnson's nomination, and that perhaps Johnson would prefer to withdraw. He said he asked Bobby one question. "Are you authorized to speak for your brother?" Bobby said no. "Come back and see the Speaker of the House when you are," Sam Rayburn said. And that was not the end of the confusion, because that was not the last of Bobby Kennedy's trips downstairs. During the next hour, there was one, the consensus among the accounts makes this the third meeting, at which he met John Connolly. Rayburn refused to see him again, so Connolly saw him alone. "It's getting worse. You've just got to convince Lyndon not to take it." Connolly reiterated Rayburn's stance, saying that Jack had made the offer, and if the offer was to be withdrawn, it had to be Jack who withdrew it. "I said, this is a very simple matter. All your brother has to do is call Mr. Johnson and say, 'I've reevaluated the situation, and I want to withdraw the offer.' He said he can't do that. I said, 'Why in the hell can't he? I'll tell you this. Mr. Johnson's not going to be persuaded by the conversations that are taking place here.'" Bobby then said, Graham puts the time at roughly 3 o'clock, that Jack would phone at once to make the formal offer. No call came, however, and, Graham says, Johnson was considerably on edge. Graham telephoned Jack, saying, "Johnson hasn't heard from you, and you'd better call him." Jack said he had assumed the message, "It's all set," he had sent through Graham, would suffice. And He said he'd call at once. But he also mentioned again the opposition to LBJ. Graham responded that he should stop vacillating, and Graham says Kennedy agreed about the finality of things. Rowe went down the hall to Johnson's suite. "Just don't go wandering," he told him. Kennedy was about to call. He did at perhaps 3:30.